Okay. Can I ask you guys a question real quick before we start this interview? Do you want to go on a date?
With you?
I'm
With
busy
you?
that day, I think.
I didn't say the day. I didn't say the day. I also didn't
Oh.
say when or even what month it would be in. Don't
Yeah,
plan.
then. Sure. What is it? Where are we going?
It's in the 7th of December in a little place I like to call Pi.
I'm there. That sounds fantastic. Will there be drag queens?
I was going to Pi that
There
day
will.
anyway.
Yeah.
Will there be food?
Yeah. There'll be food. There'll be drag queens. There'll be shows. It will be a cabaret.
And
I'm actually
us.
holding a. I'm hosting a cabaret, and I told other people who I know that you might be there. And I'm kind of relying on you to show up, so need you guys to kind of like, hold up your end of the
I can
bargain.
move some things around. I'll be there.
Yeah.
Alan, are you available?
Yeah.
There will be trans people there.
I heard there's going to be three dunces on stage who think they're really smart. And that they're kind of like, I'm
Yeah.
kind of hesitant to go because the way it was told to me was like there's going to be these three like limp-wristed post-lobotomy wastes of
Limp-wristed
human skin up on the
drunks.
stage.
Three
Yeah.
drunks.
Yeah, it's going to be the best night ever. Everyone should come.
Yeah. If you guys haven't realized from that clunky introduction, we have a wonderful show coming up for you on the 7th of December in Pie Dundrum.
Next
In the
week.
evening, next fucking week. I can't
Punch
believe
me in the
it.
face. Kill me.
We have the middle class dulcet tones of Goblins, Goblins, Goblins and Chandelier, very gifted drag queens who are going to be singing us in and out of political recess. We're going to be talking embarrassing things that we've done, embarrassing things that Radker's done, embarrassing things that Radker's done to other people. We're doing it all. We said there is no lot too big that these people don't deserve to hear. So we just said, fuck it. These people deserve faggotry.
Yeah. We might record it.
Well,
But
that's not for you to say.
I don't think we will, which because I really want to do some libel on stage. So
Yeah, leave it to the ephemera.
I don't think we'll record it, which means you have to come. Because
Right.
can you
Yeah.
imagine missing something? Like we're gonna say something really cool or funny or
Libelous. Yeah.
libelous. Yeah, we've got some secrets to
And
spill.
like, we know that you guys listen
Alan's
to
gonna say
every
slurs.
single episode, which you can't, you can never hear me say a slur on air. We know you guys listen to like every single episode. We you cling on to everything we've ever said, so you couldn't let an episode go that you haven't like listened to and that you'll never have the capacity to listen to. Like, you'd have to kill yourself. You'd have to kill yourself.
And this
So,
is a really cool opportunity to say things in Helen's face, spit in her face, their face. They like people to
misgender
spit in
them.
their face.
I
Yeah,
don't actually
misgender
don't think
them to
that.
their face.
Misgender all of us. To
Yeah.
be more equal opportunities, misgender all of us.
Yeah, misgender everyone you see there. So we have an incredible show coming up on the 7th of December, but we also have an incredible show coming into your ears in the next 3 to 4 minutes because we've
I
got a
love
really
people coming in my ears.
Okay. Because we've got an interview coming up in the next 3 to 4 minutes with journalist and writer Vincent Bevins, who's just released his second book called If We Burn, The Decade of Mass Prot Matt, what's it called?
It's not the name, but it's fine. I say it again in a few minutes, probably.
Okay,
It's
but it's about.
he was really gracious to talk to us and tell us his thoughts on protest, its failings, its wins, what it offers us in the future. It's going to be a really interesting interview.
Yeah, so it's about the decade from the 2010s to from 2010 to 2020. So we've all lived through that, and it's about the fact that there were so many protests in various different countries. He always focuses on sort of like the global south or like countries outside of like the quote unquote first world. So it's about like various different protests in those countries and why they did not achieve what they set out to achieve, and in fact why sometimes situations were a lot worse in those countries after the protests. It was a really great book, and you guys should read it. It's incredible. But more importantly, you should listen to the interview we've just done with him.
When it's about to start, but when it does, don't be alarmed. He is American. That is,
Yeah.
it's not a glitch. That is where he's from. But
Yeah.
don't hold it against him.
I thought he was
We're
from
sorry
Ballsbridge.
about that.
Okay, here's our interview with Vincent Bevins. See you on the other side.
Just to give you so my name is Glenn, and Roger, the podcast is called Casement's Leftovers because there's a kind of a national figure in Irish history called Roger Casement, who is a revolutionary. Yeah.
And I just googled him.
Yes, a very famous cruising gay diplomat who was eschewed by the kind of Catholic Ireland that took over once we shook off the clutches of the British. So we decided to do this podcast, and it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying like the leftover ideals of Roger Casement. So that's why you might have been weirded out when there was like three people talking to you with Roger Casement as their bio.
No, that's absolutely fine. I understand that you are all Roger Casement.
Yeah, exactly.
His leftovers.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Very, very, very clever, witty repartee. We are we're wordsmiths that could even put you out of business.
No. Yeah. This could. I mean, it's a Irish wordsmiths punch dangerously above their weight. Actually, it's like a real problem for publishing outside of like in the United States. Pound for pound, we're really not done. We don't do well. No.
The Irish control publishing, like.
Interesting. I think that you can. I think that if, I mean, I don't have the data here, but I think like empirically that is like defensible. Like you wouldn't even have to be doing like conspiracy theory. You could just put like the number of books sold by Irish writers versus all the other English speaking countries. Oh, yeah. And it would be wildly out of whack. I think that's right.
I know we have like an absurdly high ratio of Nobel Prize winners for literature. It's like seven of them.
I think it just appeals to people that like we write a lot about, you know, the famine and like white people being hard done by, which is obviously something that
it's because we're all liars as well though.
Yes, yeah.
Like everyone's like Irish people write storytellers. Like, yeah, have you ever tried to have like an honest conversation?
Irish people love to lie.
Yeah.
I think there's also, like my lot, like the, all of the white people in the United States that like to think of themselves as Irish love to buy cultural products from what we imagine to be our homeland.
Your homeland. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's lots of.
Oh yeah. And it is imaginary. Like that Ireland, like there's a fictional Ireland that exists, I think, in the minds of like Irish Americans and Australian Americans that has never been real, is not real now.
Well, the Ireland is fictitious, and then also the connection is also fake because it's also it's often a lot of Germans that after World War I switched to being Irish American because that was not bad, that was not seen as evil. I think just like again, like empirically, if you look at the number of Americans that claim to be Irish American, it's just like statistically quite unlikely considering the amount of people that are actually in Ireland. It's like 40 million or something.
There's a very famous book that we like that a lot of like if you talk to Irish leftists they always like quote the book like how the Irish became white so it's kind of like it's kind of a main it's kind of like a jumping off point it kind of crushes any type of pride that like although Irish people are very proud but it kind of crushes any kind of like fictitious kind of like romantic Ireland as you know all the rest of that shit but we've all gone through that. The dark night of the soul.
You can do both. If you're like an anti-imperialist Irish American or anti-imperialist that thinks he's an Irish American, you can latch on to some bits of Ireland. Or if you're like a racist cop, you can just make up some idea of Ireland that is like truly white and European and just say and claim that that's where you came from.
Yeah, people like do that in Ireland as well. That's basically like we did a podcast before about how like the Irish like right and left wing have the same heroes or like similar Like they can use the exact same mythology and the same symbols. Like it's, yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty standard for post-colonial countries, but it's just like weird, this weird like white post-colonial nation in the middle of Europe, confusing for everyone.
Yeah, they're like our little house gods. You know, you choose your pantheon and say like, well, like us. Oh, we identify with Roger Casement, so he's our little house god. He's the good one. And then if you're like a fascist, you're more like Podrick Pierce, like other guys. You're coming over to Ireland though, aren't you?
Tomorrow.
Oh my god, how do you feel?
Fine. It's going to be colder, I suppose, like slightly wetter and colder than it is here in London.
Well, you know, we just had we will talk about this later on in when it comes to talking about the book, but you know, we just had like a race riot, our first race riot in like 40 years. So
no, absolutely. That's been big news. Not only because I'm in the UK, not only on like UK social media, but Brazil social media, because the man that sort of hit the guy with the helmet was Brazilian. So I mean, imagine you've seen that a million times, but that went viral in Brazil.
Did it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, he was Brazilian and he was, you know, he did something good.
He saved somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, or maybe not, but I mean, you know, he acted, you know, unselfishly at least.
Heroically. What's the discourse around it in Berlin? Is there any interesting, or in Brazil, sorry, is there any interesting discourse around that?
Yeah, I mean, well, also the talk that I'm giving Thursday at Connolly Books is with the Brazilian academic, but it's just like, oh, you know, they're doing anti-immigration here now finally too, but you know, if you look carefully at who actually acted heroically, it was a Brazilian, and you know, just sort of normal stuff.
Yeah, and a Filipino nurse as well was like giving CPR. And the Filipino nurse is like, I guess he's like slightly effeminate and has just been getting all this horrific abuse online because he's being called a crisis actor. Like, he's like, oh, of course they're putting like a gay immigrant out there, you know? Pretty horrible.
As if it's impossible to find a Filipino nurse that doesn't perfectly match the Irish idea of masculinity.
Yeah. So, I mean, we started recording without even really kicking it off. So, we should say that we're delighted to be joined by American journalist and author Vincent Bevins. That's the American voice you heard. Hi, Vincent, again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad we could do this.
Yeah, and Vincent is like, you're the, your first book, The Jakarta Method, is one of my favorite books of all time.
Thank you.
So for those who don't know, it outlined how mass killings in Indonesia were used as a model for anti-communist actions around the world. But you've now written an excellent new book called If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution, which looks at various mass protest movements that took place around the world in the 2010s. And it poses the question, I guess, why so often these protest movements resulted in the exact opposite of what they had ostensibly been demanding. So, yeah, as we mentioned there, you're joining us on the pod today ahead of an appearance at Connolly Books in Dublin this Thursday, November 30th. Yep. So, I mean, I had a look at your website and what I noticed is that you've been on a global mega tour these past couple of months. So, first of all, how tired are you? And secondly, how does it feel to be like an international rock star? You're like the 21st century Beatle of the left.
Number one, I have post-viral fatigue, which is what I just Googled on the NHS website. So I like, in Portugal, I got like quite sick. And I think it's the kind of sickness that you, like, it's sort of inevitable when you go on tour for 7 weeks. So I'm still like the fever's gone, but I'm still quite tired. And then the second part of your question, I mean, it's funny to think about it that way, because like if you look at like, there is like literally like, oh, here's my tour dates. So it appears like it might be something that is somewhat similar to what a musician would do. But really, you're sitting in a bookstore with like 17 people that are kind of waiting for you to finish talking. So they can like move on and say that they've done something cultural with their day. I mean, bookstore event. I mean, it's been really fun to do, but it's very, very much like it's a much more humble way of shuffling around North America and Western Europe than it appears, just by like the fact that it is a tour, quote unquote.
Well, I was going to say you were in Berlin a few days ago, so that's where I live here in Berlin.
Oh, do you?
But I missed the event. I was like, I'm going to talk to him anyway. You know,
I could skip that audience.
One. Yeah, you didn't need to come. It was really good. It was organized by Bloque Latinoamericano, which is a left feminist group of migrants, mostly from Latin America. It was really good. It was really packed out with people that had quite a lot of interest in South America. That was 3 days after I got uninvited from a talk at the University of Regensburg in Germany for being too pro-Palestine. But yeah, Berlin was really great. It's all been really quite heartwarming, but it is tiring and like doesn't, you know, it's not, you know, like I said, each little event is quite nice, but it's, you know, it's a bookstore. It's a nice little, people get out of the house for an hour and do something slightly cultural. It's not, it's nothing exciting really.
Yeah, you weren't in the Mercedes-Benz Arena, no. Like 70,000 screaming fans.
No, it's next year.
Maybe for the third book. Yeah.
If you can get like 20 people in the seats and there's not like empty chairs, it's like it's quite good for books. I mean, actually, everyone across the U.S. there were like every event was full. It was really nice. But yeah, I mean, they're bookstores. You know, it's nothing really.
What question were you asked the most of throughout? Like, I mean, because the other way, there's like one of the things that we were discussing before you came on was just like, fuck, I do not want to ask him. It's just like, you know, it's like, where'd you come up with your ideas? Like, you know, like I don't, the same questions that you've been getting at like nearly every event. What would you say that they were?
Well, since we're not on an American podcast, I'm not trying to be unkind. If I could be very, very slightly unkind to the American audience.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, please do.
Oh, yeah, we please. Do it all the time. Us unkind.
There was a visible, if not palpable, hesitance to recognize that the book actually isn't about the United States. Like, especially...
Oh, yeah.
Especially, like, among people that hadn't read it, they were like, yeah, yeah, but come on, really. Like, what's it really say? Like, it's about me, right? Like, what does it say about me and my politics and in my practice and my intra-left debates in whatever political organization that I'm involved in the United States? No, come on, like, really, like, admit it. Like, what, it's about me. And I had to be like, well, no, like, it really is, I mean... Hopefully it's not a trick. It really is a history of a particular type of mass protest phenomenon that takes place predominantly, if not entirely, in the global South. Like, I got that. So I tried really hard to be nice. Like, I'm, you know, like I said, you get 20 people in the seats, you're going to be like grateful that they came. You're going to try always to answer the question. So I always tried to come up with an answer to the question. I always tried to say somehow or another how it might relate to U.S. politics or how it might relate to whatever protest event that they might have been involved in, but I often wanted to say like it's not about you precisely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then other people that, you know, people often that come at like the actual history of it, that's always great to get into because there's so much of it. But I don't mind, like, it's great to get questions like, why did you write this book? Because then you know you already know the answer, you can go through. I don't mind that kind of question at all.
Okay, good, because that's the first question that I have. Like, no, I mean, did like it's so funny because when I was reading the Jakarta Method, I was just like, fucking, like, why would you decide to get into this much detail, like listing, like in this, like almost like a granulated, very accessible, like form, when you know going in how much fucking work it is. Like, we're talking like with If We Burn, you're talking what, 200 over 200 interviews in 12 countries. Did you know going in that it was going to be that intense?
What I didn't know going in is that anybody was going to read my first book. So I wrote this proposal in the first few months of 2020 before the Jakarta Method came out, and I wanted to cast my idea for a story that is primarily about the June 2013 uprisings as widely as possible and put it in the truly global context. And I knew that I had written a kind of global history with the Jakarta Method, and I knew that I liked doing it. And I had an idea that I'd be able to do it again. But what I was not prepared for was the Jakarta Method coming out and actually selling copies. So as like I get into 2021 and 2022, and I'm realizing that I have to sit down and actually write this thing. And not only will it be, you know, does it need to be written, but some people are going to, it seemed, actually read it. Because when I pitched the first book and the second book, I just kind of assumed, oh, you know, these will kind of like be nice books that will go disappear into some corner of the world for people that are interested in these topics. So in retrospect, I knew that it would be quite a lot of work, but I probably bit off more. I bit off the maximum amount that I could chew given the years that I had. And then of course, like, the pandemic like stopped me from traveling for a while, so I was just reading. But yeah, I mean, like, it was quite a lot of work, but I thought it was worth doing. But I also thought that it would be, as a result sort of inevitably incomplete, right? Like when you do a history about events that are this recent, you have to, as I say, like in the conclusion of the book, like we're going to find out more stuff. Like there's going to be stuff that comes out later that will be shocking and will be needed to add it to this history. So while the first book is also quite wide ranging in its scope, while the Jakarta Method is like also global and very ambitious, it's kind of more of a slam dunk. It's kind of more of like you can kind of wrap it up with a bow and be like, well, that, you know, this, I can sort of like slam my fist on the table and say that this is the point and this is the final one. Whereas in the case of the second book, If We Burn, the conclusions are a bit more open-ended. It's a little bit more difficult to write and I think to read. Not that it's like hard to read, but I mean, there's the what it says about the world, they're not quite as obvious as what the Jakarta Method says, I think. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I mean, but I think you do a really good job. Like, I love the last two chapters and I think they do a really good job of like coming up with something that like the reader can take away. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah, like I think that is really present throughout the book, is that you have these like really large questions, or I kept thinking like you're posing really large questions, I think, throughout. Like it reminds me kind of Adam Curtis in the way that you like explain things from like first principles and you're talking about very broad. Is that like a conscious thing, or am I just drawing a line that's not there?
It's conscious that I draw upon the ways that people actually make associations in their brain. So in the case of the Jakarta Method, I knew that to get people to know or to care about something, you have to, there's two ways that the human like memory works, right? It's like association and repetition. So with the Jakarta Method, I knew that I would be able to make the 1965 massacre more real if I linked it to stuff that people had heard of. So people, like a lot of leftist readers, will have heard of Chile 1973. They will have heard of this CIA. So I wanted to like submerge it in a web of association so that like people can draw lines in their own mental maps from stuff that they know to stuff that they're just finding out about. Now, I wasn't copying Adam Curtis. I've only seen like 1.5 of his documentaries, but I think he does that too. He uses also association, which is maybe apparently surface level, because some of the associations that I make in both books are like almost rhetorical in the ways in which that they are. So I hope that there's like quite substantive analysis and substantive
absolutely
things that bring together, but they're also kind of like literary device. Like
like
Jakarta in the first book is more, you know, the word is more of a literary device than actually the point, right? Like it allows you to connect. I mean, it's a real thing that existed in the world. Jakarta came up on the walls. Jakarta was the name of these programs. But it was a metonym for the actual actors, but it's also a metonym in the book. It allows you to make to draw these lines. And I think I do some of that in the second book as well. So, some things come up, some references are used, some terms or phrases are invoked, which hopefully helps to bring the thing together in a human way on top of all of the like hard structural analytical stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a method of storytelling. But like on what you were saying earlier, so I was really interested when I was reading it in kind of what you said earlier about how you're writing about a very recent history. And in that way, like we don't know, like we fundamentally can't know what's going to happen next in the stories that you're telling, right? And it reminded me about like kind of like how, I don't know, it gave me a perception that like the current epoch that we're in is very new. That was something that I kept coming up for me. And like one line that really stood out to me is one that like actually later on kind of turns out to be like not as relevant, because Dilma has like changed her mind on it. But it's in the chapter on A Giant Awakens, where Dilma doesn't agree with Putin and Erdogan saying that like there's Western actors like working within your country to like overthrow you.
Right.
And she says her theory was that when you deliver citizenship and its associated social benefits to a previously oppressed group of people, they're going to ask for even more. That was only natural. And it made me think that like in most of the world, we're in the places that have democracy are in very new stages of democracy. And then there are so many places in the world that like don't have democracy or have like bastardized versions of democracy. And another thing about the book, I thought, is it also showed us like how recent sort of colonialism was, like explicitly, and how the times we live in are still economically colonial. I guess I just think this is a really broad question. But like the idea that we don't really know what it looks like to actually give choice, I guess, to the global south or to people right. that have always been without choice. And we don't know what the results will be when we do that. Would you, I don't know, would you agree with that? Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's an interesting thing that comes up in Egypt behind, like, people that really look at, like, U.S. actors, like the actual guys and girls that are doing U.S. foreign policy in the 21st century. Before I get to that, like Dilma's quote back in 2013, I think she still believes that bit. She still believes 100%, like the phrase in the PT was something like, people have been taken care of inside the house and now they're concerned about outside the house, because, you know, the Lula model of making lives better for Brazilians often consisted of increased consumption power. You could buy your first refrigerator, you could buy your first washing yeah. machine. But 2013, if you want to interpret it this way, which I think makes just as much sense as anything else, is about, okay, well, now I want the bus to come on time and to be affordable. Mm-hmm. I want my education to be at the same level as the, you know, the soccer stadiums we're building for FIFA. But yeah, as to the role of U.S. imperialism, I think she kind of doesn't know. And I think that neither do I exactly. Like, I think we'll kind of, some bits of it are clear. Some bits of the U.S. intervention from 2013 to 2018 are clear, but I bet there's more we'll find out in the future. But when it comes to, like, democracy in the global South, the United States is an interesting empire because it is, and it is an empire that, in our ideological DNA, requires us to deny that we are an empire. So if you went back to most empires through history, you know, British being the last really big famous one, they're like, yeah, we're an empire. We are civilizing these countries. We have
yeah.
imperial posts throughout the world. This country needs to be held in this particular place because that's best for us. And they're just open about it. The United States, you have these two sort of dueling impetuses or instincts not only in the state, but I think in the minds of, like, many of the actual people working in the State Department. And this came up in Egypt. Like, on one hand, people really wanted Egypt to get democracy because that, in, like, some deep quasi-spiritual sense, like, that's what they're supposed to believe. And they also believe that somehow, if any country gets democracy, they're always going to choose to be like us because we're so good and the whole world just wants to be like us. But then what really happens, if you give Egyptians democracy, and this becomes clear from 2011 to 2013, and I think we'll find out. We know some extent, we know about some of this, is that the reactionary Gulf monarchies, I think, are pushing the United States toward realizing if you actually give Egyptians democracy, what they're going to want is to, number one, oppose Israel, and number two, oppose Saudi Arabian power in the region.
Yeah.
Definitionally, Egyptian democracy, and this was understood by many of the people that put together the uprising in 2011, is going to take on Washington's partners in the region. And so then you get these, like, you know, deep down, well-meaning officials in the U.S. government, perhaps even including Obama, realizing, oh, wait, actually, when you give Arabs democracy, oh, wait, that's the reason we supported Israel and Saudi Arabia in the first place, is because we needed to keep these particular aspirations bottled up if we're going to keep the same configurations of power that we've constructed in the Cold War, in the Cold War era in the Middle East. So, like, you know, like, this was, you know, this even happens with Hamas, right? Like, they're like, oh, fuck. They, you know, Gaza had elections and they voted for an Islamist insurgency. Well, let's just cancel. Let's just, like, cut them off from the rest of the world forever and hope they go away. So it's clearly there's something, yeah. there's some kind of a strange, deep contradiction within the U.S. state and its allies around the world that, like, we're technically supposed to believe that we're extending liberty to everybody. But when that liberty is extended and people actually want to join the first world in a material sense, because this is often what was a huge error that was made, I think a fundamental error that drives a lot of the history that I try to tell in this book, is that people in Egypt or in Tunisia or in Brazil were saying, we want to be like the first world in the sense of, we want your stuff. Like, give us your money. You've shut us out from the global system. We want to be equals with you. We want to, like, claw our way up to live alongside you, which means taking away your privileges. But then, like, Anderson Cooper, like CNN, shows up in Tahrir Square and sees in the square, oh no, they want to join us as junior partners. They want to be like America, yeah. like the B team of America. And this, I think, contradiction powers a lot of tragedy that unfolds in the decade.
Yeah, and I think you see the same, or definitely a similar dynamic with Western conceptions of Ukraine and what like a Ukraine that is going to be closer to the West would look like as well.
Right.
I think that, because you mentioned Palestine and Israel there, and I mean, obviously this is a hot topic now. I think in general, in the West, and I think this has been exposed now, people don't realize just how big of an issue this is for, in the minds of the average Arab or Muslim out there, right, in the Middle East. And I think you highlight this in the book, how the issue of Palestine has always been this massive unifying force across the Arab world when it comes to the masses, in spite of what their political leaders might do or say about the issue.
Yeah.
And this like fervent pro-Palestinianism has been powerful enough to be this mobilizing force within countries like Egypt and Tunisia. And I think that is downplayed massively in the West. And so we're talking about protests, right? So we're currently seeing right now mass protests happen across the world, in the West too, even here in Germany, in favor of Palestine. You also get a lot of them in favor of Israel, against Israeli actions, right? These protests are happening across the world. And my guess is that Israeli authorities this time have been shocked by the scale and passion of these protests, because obviously what we're seeing now, the attacks are particularly heavy-handed, but it's not as if this is the first time they've ever bombed or laid siege to Gaza. So as the new expert on mass protest movements, do you think there's, I know this is going away from the book a bit, but do you think there's potential for this global movement we're seeing now, or I don't even know if you call it a global movement, is there potential there for change in the situation of Palestine going forward? Like, are we looking at a rupture in the Palestine question, or do you think pretty soon we're going to return to the status quo, the only difference being a whole lot of dead Palestinians?
I think it could go either way, but I think that even if there's a return to the status quo ante, because, you know, there's a long-term ceasefire and people get distracted by something else, the shift that has been effected by what I do think is a global movement does matter, I think, in the long term. One thing that becomes clear in the book, you know, tragically, brutally clear, is that protests are fundamentally communicative actions. And so if they don't actually disrupt power, if they don't actually impose costs on the people that are making the decisions, they can simply be ignored, right? So what really matters to Israel is not popular opinion in Egypt, because they know that popular opinion in Egypt is wildly anti-Zionist. What matters is Sisi staying in power. So what matters to Israel is not even really popular opinion in the United States. It's the position of Joe Biden. But the position of Joe Biden seems to be, like, he seems to be kind of like, there was that a couple days ago, he seems to have apologized in private for casting doubt on the number of dead in Gaza. If you look at the attitudes among young Americans, including young American Jews, I mean, almost every Jew that I know in the United States that's my age or younger has gone through a sort of similar trajectory, which is that they grew up kind of believing they were sort of Zionist in the broadest sense. They hadn't really thought about it too much. And they learned more. Maybe they learned a lot. Maybe they went to Palestine and now they actually are quite critical. So those things matter in the long term. They matter for, again, the particular configurations of power that make Israel's current actions possible, which tend to be more about Sisi and Biden than like the people of planet Earth. Because like the last survey that I found on Egypt, and this is in 2020. So this is before I was actually in Cairo doing reporting for this book the last time that Israel bombed Gaza. So this survey came out in 2020, before the 2020-21 bombardment, before what's happening now. Only 13% of Egyptians believe that there should be diplomatic ties between Israel and Egypt, and 85% are against. So, like, again, this is, as you say, this is a thing that every Arab knows. But in the U.S., we kind of just, you know, including, you know, in my upbringing, too, it was just kind of, you were just kind of taught in a vague sense that, oh, that, you know, there's a homeland for the Jews, and that's a nice thing because of the Holocaust. And I think in the last few years, it has been more difficult to ignore that. For a lot of different reasons, because, you know, perhaps, you know, a lot of different reasons, some some positive, some negative. But yeah, I think the fact that they're like, you see like desperate attacks to attack the social media platforms on which the like the images are being spread are indicative that people are a little bit uncomfortable with shifts in global opinion. Like going after TikTok as if that is the thing that really matters is a bit of a, is a bit revealing. The way that, that, I mean, I imagine you all don't like the T-shirt very much, but the, I mean, what do you think about, like, to me, that the way that they went after that statement, that very mild statement, what was that, like 2 days ago? I'm sure you all saw that, right?
Yeah.
What actually happened?
Well, so this is Leo Varadkar, his tweet talking about, I think the phrase was, he's talking about this Irish Israeli girl who was freed by Hamas, and then he says, completely innocuously, and we are not ones to defend Leo Varadkar on this podcast, he says, she's been lost and now she's been found, which is just like a weird like literary flair he tried to add to his tweet. That's all it is.
Yeah, it's a moment from the Bible of like euphoria because a child's come home. Again, the fact that Israel went after that, like, again, that's kind of a tell to me, you know, that smacks a little bit of desperation. It's kind of like, come on, is this really,
sure.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
are you really going after this man? And so I think that, I think the shift matters. But again, I do think that the demonstrations remain demonstrations. They can be ignored as long as they don't change the concrete configurations of power, which really matter. Biden, it seems, is probably noticing this could really cost him votes next year. Democrats, I mean, I don't know how much of... I mean, I imagine like all of the internet is poisoned with U.S. political discourse, even if you try your hardest to ignore it. But people, there's been quite a lot of meltdowns in the Democratic Party over the realization that quite a lot of people are not going to vote for Joe Biden because of this. And that kind of thing matters, I think, more than the demonstration itself. Unless, and this is the case in my book, I only analyze cases like this in the book, demonstrations get so large that they actually do overthrow or fundamentally destabilize governments. Now, that's not going to happen in the United States. I don't think it's going to happen in Israel, but it could happen in an Arab country. You could see, I mean, it seems that Sisi is not comfortable with what's going on. I mean, he's put in a very awkward position. I mean, as is every Arab leader, because you're required. And this is, you know, against all of these very racist and offensive narratives that, you know, the Arab world can't have democracy because of the Arab mind or because of Islam. If you want a better reason for why the Arab world can't have democracy, it's because all of the leaders in that region are required to maintain a configuration of geopolitical power that all of their people oppose. And so Sisi, I think, as like unintelligent of a leader as he is, understands that this is a problem right now. And so you could see these protests like doing something like another so-called Arab Spring. It's imaginable.
Well, that's really interesting. So, I mean, like, you're talking about the protests being fundamentally communicative. So I guess we should get into this, because I think this is like the real meat of the book in terms of what are these mass protests? When do they work? When don't they work? So, you also start the book kind of talk about how protest is this relatively new thing, which is one of those things that like you never think about, but obviously makes sense when you do think about it, because obviously mass protest makes no sense before mass media, right? Because if you go to the town square and there's no internet or TV and you stage a protest, nobody else in the country is going to know about it.
Except for the six guys that are like selling bread at that in this town square.
Yeah, exactly. So you also note that the decade that you're talking about, we saw more protests than across the world than any other time in history. How much of this rise in protests do you see as actually specifically an expression of the death of politics, right? And of the death of mass organizations like parties and trade unions. So like protest, how much is it an expression of an impotent population, unable actually to enact change in any other way? So, I mean, so a lot of the countries that you deal with are literally just not democracies. So, I mean, it's a lot more explicit there. But like even in countries that ostensibly are, like Brazil, is protest sometimes this desperate kind of clinging on to any last semblance of democracy that they have left? Would you see it that way?
I think that you pointed to one of the several elements. I think I say in the conclusion that there is an elective affinity between particular forms and particular material conditions. So to explain the explosion of this particular type of mass protest in this era. I think you need a couple, I think always you're going to need multiple causality to explain something, you know, that gets this many people involved. But I think you pointed to a couple of them. I think one, you do have the concrete decimation of mass political organizations, of the party form, of working class organizations, of all of the ways in which in the first half of the 20th century it would have been seen as natural for human beings to be working together collectively towards some kind of political goal. Like the end of mass politics, you know, and sometimes the end of mass politics happens, you know, in the first world, it happens as people become atomized and individualized, or in, you know, Indonesia, the Communist Party is actually, you know, decimated, everyone is killed. So you get the decimation of mass political organizations. You get the crisis of representation more generally, right? And so you get a situation in which, correctly, people believe that the organs which are supposed to represent them no longer really do so. So this is true both in what is left of our, you know, advanced democracies in the first world, and it's certainly true in places where there was never any links with democratic structures in the first place. And then you get media, right? So both social and traditional media make it easier to put together this particular type of protest. So it's not, that doesn't mean that it's, that's what they're about really, but all of these other possible ways of responding to injustice, all of these other possible ways of organizing with other human beings to push for change became much more difficult. What became very, very easy was to get everyone mad at the same post on a Tuesday and into the streets on a Wednesday. And so this thing made it very easy to scale up horizontal, apparently spontaneous protests, without people necessarily knowing the other people that were involved or knowing or really agreeing on what protest is about. So just to summarize, just because, you know, we're getting to the point where I might as well, I come to the conclusion that in the 2010s, a particular very specific type of response to injustice becomes hegemonic, if not indeed appearing to be the natural way to respond to injustice. And that is the apparently spontaneous, digitally coordinated, horizontally structured, mass protest in public squares and or in public spaces. And all of those elements come from somewhere. And as I've just tried to outline, some of that is like material conditions, like the concrete decimation of the other organizations that would have maybe done different things. And then there's also the ideological currents which exist, especially in the English-speaking first world, that say, well, the more everyone's individualized, that's good anyways. The less structure there is, that's good anyways. The more post-ideological that a movement is, that's good anyways. And all of these come together to create this explosive combination, which ends up being far more effective than anticipated, far more effective than I think that was planned for at getting people on the streets. And my book ends up being about, like, well, what happens next? What happens when this particular, very particular and specific recipe gets so many people onto the streets that it actually overthrows a government or fundamentally destabilizes one? And then as we go across the world, in, you know, 10 to 13 countries, different things happen in different places. But this is the dynamic that I identify as being behind the explosions around which I try to build a global history.
Do you know what, Vincent? It's so interesting because you have this like literary quirk, which I really, really enjoy, is where you say things kind of like very simply. You explain things to somebody as if they might be like an alien listening to you for the first time. I remember it was at the start of your book, you said you explained the United States, which is just so perfect. You said the United States, a Western European settler colony. It's just like, just in case you were asleep for the last couple of hundred years. I got the chills a little bit towards the end of the book because you were talking about, like, you know, different types of protests and how they might contrast with a kind of like nuts and bolts organizational address to, say, political instability. And you say, well, is this better than like gathering in a group and then walking across a city a couple of times? And you're just like, oh God, that is what a protest is. It's just like, I'm being like trite, but that was what the quote was. Like, I mean, it's just, that is really, it's very basic form that they can kind of draw links between all of these different protests in the global south and just like the world in general, is this idea that like if we come together as a community, as a society, quote unquote, like we're going to enact change because they're going to look at us and they're going to be just like, wow, look at all those voters or whatever. And one of the things that comes up a lot in the interviews that you conduct is like kind of a media industry, including social media, which has this kind of like misunderstanding or misinterpreting of the impetus or political outcomes of protests, like not knowing exactly where it's going to go and not really knowing all of the reasons, because all of these people are obviously all individuals with loads of different reasons to be on the street together, you know, protesting the same thing. And I wondered why you thought that sometimes in the face of that kind of complexity and this kind of reluctance to create any type of stratified or like hierarchical traditional system, which is proven to, you know, be able to stand the test of time when everybody kind of like gets bored of protesting on the streets and goes home, why there tends to be this kind of like inclination to start leading into kind of Les Mis discourse, where people start to kind of get like, I mean, I felt for the interviewees when they were saying like, right. I turned around and I saw these protests and I was just like, wow, it's happening. And I wondered, because I felt that as well, like,
yeah,
in Ireland, this country, it's like, I mean, you feel this like groundswell, this like, I think this is one of the things that like Helen has mentioned quite a few times in the podcast, is this like, this like idea of like collective, is, I think it was, I don't know if Helen, you can correct me, the is it a situationist thing, like, or a happening thing? Anyways.
Oh, yeah, as in like the Guy Debord idea of like something that happens outside of capital, like outside of like capitalism or outside of like structures of profiteering or whatever, like, what is it, like, and how good that feels.
Détournement or something, this word where they would have.
Détournement, yeah.
They would walk around Paris and then they would like turn left when like society thought they were going to turn right. And that was
No, but I'm always like, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the original.
I mean, it is cool, like it is powerful theoretically,
but why do you think that these all leaned into this kind of romanticized version of protest rather than a very boring committee event where, like, you know, like, or having a structure where there's a treasurer and an, like, you know, I can understand obviously that this is exciting, but like if the political outcome is not proven to work, it's essentially a kind of performance and a cross your fingers hope that something will happen.
Well, I think that the question of the necessary mediation and representation of protests becomes important here. And again, like, this runs throughout the whole book. I wish the media wasn't so important, but I think it really is quite important. I think it matters that for the class of people that hold the biggest microphones in the global economy, and I'm including myself, which is the people that work for the US corporate media, it is kind of true that everything just did sort of work out for us for the last 250 years. Like, if you are a member of the like North American upper middle to ruling class, every time you kind of asked for something, you did just get it. So there was this deep assumption, and this was read into the Berlin Wall and read into the fall of communism, even though this is not what actually happened. This is not what people actually remember. This is not what people actually lived through, that dealt with the real like decimation and starvation and collapse after the end of the Soviet Union. I think there was this deep idea among the type of people, including myself, that were tasked with interpreting these undeniably inspiring images. Because it is undeniably inspiring to see Egyptians of every walk of life coming together and, you know, fighting and risking their lives and asking for something better. But the people that were tasked with interpreting this often made reference to just kind of the way that they just sort of thought history worked, which was that, like, oh, if everybody asks for the good thing, then they get it. And this is also like the story we tell ourselves about the Black Civil Rights Movement in the United States, which is totally wrong. Number one, like white liberals in the United States are told that like everybody asked for a solution and then they just got it, whereas there was like real fighting carried out by hierarchically organized, very disciplined civil rights groups in the 50s and 60s, and then the wins that they got were quite limited. Economic justice never, ever came, not even close for Black Americans. So I think that there's these deep assumptions that, like, well, that's all you have to do. And I mean, like, I took this out of the book, but, like, do you remember Kony 2012?
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah.
Ooh.
It was like, this was a really fascinating moment because this guy, and I think it's not, you know, it's relevant. Like, a white guy from the San Diego, I don't know if you guys know what San Diego is, a white guy from, like, the suburbs of Southern California truly believed that if you raised enough awareness about some bad guy somewhere in Africa, then magically the solution would provide itself. Like, he truly believed, it was really this really sad thing, because I think he truly believed, and I think that, like, the American liberal that believes in meritocracy really believes that there's, like, a referee to history. Like, if you can, like, catch Kony doing something bad in Africa and the whole world knows about it, well, then that's it. Then someone's going to swoop in and stop him. Whereas there was absolutely no mechanism whatsoever from going from raising awareness about Kony to whatever it was. It wasn't even clear what he wanted. Like, literally the whole point of the campaign was make him famous.
He's
famous. Okay, he's famous now. Everybody knows. And I think that is buried deep in especially the North American white ideological code. And I think a lot of it died, actually, from 2010 to 2020.
Didn't one of your interviewees, I think, was it Hong Kong, where I think you were like reading back in the conclusion of the book when you're asking these people, okay, what did you learn, or what would you say to somebody who's trying to, you know, deliver something moving forward? And I think one of your interviewees said, oh, I kind of didn't realize how entrapped people were. We were to pop culture. Like, we had this kind of expectation that something was going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Hong Kong case is quite tragic because this set of demonstrations, set of protests, was given so much positive feedback in Western media, because China's bad and they're protesting a bad thing, so you don't need to ask any other questions, right? You know, these kids, quite tragically, one kid told me, I wish we had studied history of some kind rather than just, like, believing Hollywood. Another kid told me, we got caught in a loop of just doing whatever was going to get Western media positive reinforcement from Western media. So we got in this sort of perverse feedback loop, or positive or negative feedback loop, where we just did whatever it seemed was going to get us more attention. And then we just did more of that. And then it just, again, just then what? Big question mark. And another kid said, you know, we were used by the United States. The United States was interested in using us as a hammer with which to beat Beijing, but, like, we had, in retrospect, I have no idea what we wanted to happen. Like, what was the, like, what was supposed to happen? And it's quite, yeah, I mean, you know, it goes without saying, that's quite, like, a tragic type of recollection to have. So I try to always, you know, every single protest in the book, I mean, I select the protests in the book based on how big they get, not my ideological affinity. So, like, they're all over the place ideologically, but I try to come at them with some sympathy, because, like, that is just, like, it's just, no matter what, how much you agree or disagree with the final outcome of something like the Hong Kong protests, it's just, like, it's horrible to like dunk on somebody that's coming to that conclusion on their own, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, that's what people told me in Hong Kong. One guy said, we were used by the US. One guy said, we just did what we thought Hollywood indicated we would do. And, you know, and, like, and then one guy said, you know, what did we think? We weren't going to beat China, right? We weren't going to, and, like, there was never any point where a majority of, or Hong Kongers came anywhere near wanting independence, right? So the vast majority of Hong Kongers always wanted to stay in the PRC. And so then what was the actual idea? And then the fact that they said, well, we don't really know. We just kind of thought the escalation would lead us somewhere. It's something that, again, tragically, I kind of believed deep in my bones when I was covering Brazil 2013. I didn't know what was supposed to happen, but I just thought that somehow or another it would be good if millions of people entered the streets behind, quote unquote, a pro-social democratic set of protests. But as I learned in Brazil, behind is not actually the same as afterwards. You know, you can come chronologically next, but that doesn't mean you're actually behind the first thing. And you know, this kind of strange slippage happened all over the world.
Yeah. And I think like one of the reasons it was so interesting to read the book is because a lot of the conflicts that are mentioned now, like it's very interesting to me which one of them I like didn't know about at all, like Tunisia, but the ones that are in countries that were more covered here, like in the West, like Hong Kong and Ukraine, were ones that when they were happening, I was like, what am I supposed to think here? What am I, whose side am I supposed to be on here? Right. What am I supposed to believe?
Who's the goodies?
Which is also such a Western way to think about and frame everything. Right. And like, what I really like about the book is that you just explain exactly what they are and you show similarities in the things that happen. Like, you know, the amount of people that come, the application, like how high the volume of force is, or how much force is used by the police, what I'm trying to say there. The effects that have, but like the reasons that the people are on the street are like incredibly varied and specific, contextually specific, right? But yeah, like when reading it, I was struck by being like, I don't know what I'm supposed to think. And a lot of the time, like the things that we choose to care about are things that are mediated to us, right? And that just makes sense because they're things that we can see and understand. But then that means that, like, I find that a lot of people in the world end up focusing on things that are hypothetical. Like, you find this often with, like, the trans debate, where, like, so many people in the world now, or especially, like, in the UK, are spending their time being like, what if a person did transition in order to rape someone in a bathroom? And you're like, it's never, ever, ever happened. Like, you, a completely immaterial... right. Like, it's a hypothetical, and then people make policy and they have conversations and they lose their entire livelihoods, if you're Graham Linehan, to hypothetical situations. And it's a crazy way that we live. And like, I found that with Hong Kong, I thought it was really interesting at the time because people resonate with something just because they're standing up against the police, right? That happens so often that specific groups in the West will resonate with a movement just because they are facing police repression. And I remember seeing, because Hong Kong, I always was very like, this seems really confusing to me. I don't know what's going on here. It was really, really intelligent.
But the images were cool, right? Like a lot of it was like, you know, I remember that it was all about like these videos of these Chinese, or sorry, these Hong Kong kids who had
canceled,
developed techniques of like throwing back tear gas canisters at the police.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah.
It's surrounded with the jumper and everyone was like, that's so cool. But no engagement with what they were protesting.
Yeah. And like from a tactical perspective, it was really interesting. But I remember being in Kotti in Berlin and they had a big fucking mural of one of the Hong Kong protesters up outside Mamba Ulfa. And I was like, guys, like, come on now. Like it's because the anarchists there are just like, they're facing off the police like we do. And I'm like, guys, like what? But I, sorry, like,
I mean,
this,
not I to be, not to be, I mean, this is kind of like a little bit too far, but like the January 6th protesters faced off with the police.
Exactly, though. The protests,
that's why they're heroes.
I mean, this, it's so pertinent.
They were baddies,
though. It's so pertinent to Dublin right now. Like, protest is not an inherently a good thing. It's not inherently, it's not a march of progress. Inherently,
that's hopefully this is something that comes out across the book, because again, some people that like don't read the book and then they like find out that Ukraine's in it, or find out that Hong Kong's in it, or find out that they're like, oh my god, I can't believe he's writing a book about how the Hong Kong protests were the best thing that ever happened. It's just like, no, I've just chosen everyone based on how big they get, and hopefully what you learn, and hopefully because I like, again, I'm glad that you like noticed that, because I try not to be like, this is a good one and this was a real one and this is a fake one and this is a, you know, I just kind of try to explain, and I allow people to come and decide what their own level of sympathy is for each protest. But hopefully what becomes clear across the whole book and across the whole decade is that no matter what your politics are, there is nothing ontologically progressive about any tactic.
Yeah.
You can do a protest or civil rights for black people. You can do a protest demanding a military coup, as they did in, you know, as they did in Chile in 1973, in Brazil in 1964. You can do a protest for QAnon reasons. You can do, you know, you could, a protest is a tool, and it can be used by any group of people for any reason. And often that tool only really makes sense if it is part of a larger strategic process. So yeah, like in 2019, I remember, I mean, probably 2014 was interesting because it happened so quickly. Well, I'm gonna get back to Hong Kong again. Hong Kong's quite interesting because two things about the Hong Kong protest only really make sense if you understand the degree to which these protests are mediated and they sort of copy elements from other protests, and then the ways in which certain elements are reinforced on the streets because they appear apparently similar to other ones. Number one, the umbrella movement in Hong Kong in 2014 was a copy of Occupy Wall Street, which was a copy of Tahrir Square, which was inspired by Tunisia. But by 2014, if you had actually been paying attention to Egypt, it didn't work. So this was a copy of a tactical approach that was not only carried out in a wildly different country, because in Egypt, that's the capital. You can shut down the whole country. But Hong Kong is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the population of the PRC. All of the decisions are really made in Beijing. It didn't make a lot of sense to try to shut down a corner of the country that Beijing didn't care about, number one. Number two, if you were to do surveys in 2013 in Hong Kong, almost no ethnic Chinese Hong Kongers would have said that police brutality is a big problem. Like, they just didn't have that. Like, in Brazil, in the United States, in Egypt, like, everybody knew the cops were evil. They just didn't really have this. But again, they end up escalating towards a particular type of confrontation with state security forces, I think partially because of the way that you just described, that the rest of the world will see it as inherently positive because if you're facing off with cops. We all know cops are repressive. Cops are repressive by definition. Cops use violence to reinforce the given inequality that exists in any society, but every single society has them. And so, yeah, Hong Kong was quite interesting because both these elements became employed in ways that I don't think would have made sense without mediation and without representation. And certainly didn't make sense if you wanted to, like, get Beijing to do a different thing. Because unless you're going to leave China, which, as I said, there was never a point at which anything close to 50% of Hong Kong wanted to leave China, you aren't going to be, for better or worse. And I mean, this is, you know, if you hate the Communist Party of China, this is quite an unenviable situation to be in. But whether you like it or not, you're going to have to act in concert with the PRC to get changes. So at a certain point, it was just very hard for me to, you know, sitting in Indonesia or Brazil, to understand exactly what was supposed to happen. And I remember I had conversations with this on WhatsApp with people that were there, and I literally said to one of my friends, "What do you think is going to happen?" And again, I'm not trying to be rude. I'm not trying to dunk on people that are, like, believed in sort of some kind of process to improve the world. But he literally hadn't thought about it. He was like, "Well, you know, look at how bad they are, and look at the kids are good." And I was like, "Yeah, but what do you and what?" And
hey, it's Matt. Just jumping in here. So from this point on, we had some small technical difficulties. You might notice Vincent's sound is a little bit different. Bear with us. It's just a few minutes to the end. And he finishes this point, and then we finish up.
What I was finishing is just saying, in 2019, I was sort of, there was quite a demand that everybody ally themselves with whatever was happening in Hong Kong. And perhaps it was because of what I lived through in 2013, or my own, you know, sort of hesitance to jump into any conclusions about the PRC, that I didn't do that. I was like, I don't, you know, I've been looking at this for quite a long time. I was already working on the book, really. And actually, I'd already, like, put down the Hong Kong protests as, like, in the fail category before they even ended. So, I remember that. I remember there was quite a big, like, get involved with this. And it was like, look, I have sympathy to any kid that's trying to, you know, improve their country or their world or whatever, but I'm not, you can't make me join optimistic. Every single thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I said earlier, you're now the expert on mass protests, right? You're the talking head destined to be called probably onto CNN or whatever anytime there's a mass protest.
I don't think CNN, maybe.
Maybe Democracy Now.
Box News. Breitbart. Okay.
But yeah, so I mean, simple question in how I'm going to ask it, but definitely not a simple answer. Like, what? How then do we change the world? What is the most efficient and effective way to do this? If you know what I mean? Do you have a good answer for that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when it comes to protest type stuff, empirical research shows that hierarchically organized movements do better than horizontal ones. They also show that ruling elites do respond more to boycotts and strikes than they do to, as you said earlier, walking back and forth across a country. That's like a very basic building block of the larger answer. I think the larger answer is that we live in such a complex and interconnected economic and political system, or such a complex set of economic and political systems, that building a better world really requires the actual construction of a better world. You can't really just kill the king and then the repression goes away. So Olufemi Otaiwo, an American philosopher who did my talk in Washington, D.C. with me, who moderated, he calls this constructive politics. But I mean, this is a classic thing. Part of the revolutionary tradition is that revolution is not just the break. It is not just the moment at which the existing system stops working. It's building a better one. And that can happen slowly. It can happen after a break. But it is the actual building of a better world that you want to get to. Even though the moment of like fire and everything falling apart and everything collapsing is probably more cinematic and cool looking. What you actually want is to build a world in 5, 10, 50 years where more people have better, you know, more people have access to food and healthcare and people have better lives, rather than sort of like inviting the fantastic moment of fire and brimstone.
Mm. I think it's a really good answer. And great to hear Femi Taiwo reference that. This is a Femi Taiwo fan cast.
You should get him. Tell him to make him come on.
We would like to do that. Yeah.
Yes, we will.
So one final question. And so you were brave and ambitious enough, Vincent, to proclaim the 2010s the mass protest decade, right?
Right.
It's like one of these things that like really confident historians do, you know, like to name an epoch or an era, to give it this name. So what I want you to do is to go on record with your prediction for what the 2020s will come to represent. And I want a catchy overgeneralization.
Yeah, as trite as possible.
That's what I'm after.
The 2020s will be... okay, the 2020s will be the time of chilling. It will be the time everybody will, you know, get together, relax a little bit. Nothing will happen.
That was the 90s. Yeah. We've had that.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2020s will be the decade... Again, the mass protest decade, I think, is quite right. I think it'll be... I don't know, do we think it'll be the decade when climate... Like when climate becomes real, like, you know, will it be tragically the decade that all sort of everything else, all other constructive projects, all of the best plans are like cast aside by like emergency? Could be the emergency decade. Maybe it's the emergency decade.
Neoliberalism might collapse, but then like what is going to crawl up out of the dust in its wake?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I did a thing recently for The Nation, which I argued that kind of neoliberalism is collapsing, but not because it's brutal or inefficient, but because China's winning. So the people in Washington, D.C. that created the Washington consensus, the people that created the global neoliberal order, are getting nervous that a competitor is winning at the game that they designed. So, you know, maybe it's, you know, yeah, the deglobalization decade. I mean, the United States has already sort of started on the path to destroying the world order they constructed. Trump was a big step in this. If he wins again, they'll be even further. We'll be further along on that path. Or maybe it's the sanctions decade. Maybe it's the decade in which the United States put sanctions on literally every country in the whole world. Until effectively it's just sanctions on the United States, until it ultimately you realize you've just cut yourself out of the global economy. Yeah, maybe the emergency decade, maybe the sanctions decade.
Well, that's a lot to look forward to.
Yeah. I think as well, like, and it comes up in your book as well, like the topic of immigration is going nowhere. And I think that's going to be like, as in, as when it comes to climate, when it comes to destabilizing forces around the world, like, refugees are not going anywhere. There's just going to be more and more of them. And I think, yeah, which is a question, and I think in the middle of your book, you kind of touch on a question that, like, no one really has any sufficient answer
answer was the Third World Movement. The real answer was, back in the 50s exactly. and 60s, yeah. was to properly decolonize the global economy. Because if you had actually done what everybody believed that should have been done back then, at least everybody in the Global South, that the people of the formerly colonized nations should be able to take their rightful place alongside the rich first world, you would not have immigration except for a kind of a net zero of, like, people going to study abroad or whatever.
Yeah.
There would not be mass flows of people that are objectively, materially, rationally pursuing a better life by crossing the Mediterranean, because the idea would have been, oh, things are just as good in Algeria. I mean, or at least life makes just as much sense in Algeria or the Congo as it does in Italy, which it does not at the moment. And unfortunately, I don't see a way of us solving that problem. So we're going to see, so climate fascism, I think, is a real possibility, like, bringing up the gates, pulling up the gates.
I think we're definitely seeing, like, the man behind the curtain more and more. But I think, like, one of the big, really interesting messages from your book is that, like, history isn't a march of progress, and it's not even a march to anywhere or at any particular speed. And so, like, the most, like, important lesson we can learn from that is that, like, we have to try and, like, take control, I guess, of what's going to happen, and we have to, like, try and be organized. So
there was ideological movements in the late 90s and early 21st century to identify, in a sort of, like, hangover from, like, Marxist teleology, I think, to try to find ways in which to believe that atomization and individualization and the end of working class power were somehow good. And I wish that they were right. I sympathize with the attempt to find out ways that they were good, but maybe they're just not. And if history is pushing you in a way which is not good, that means you have to sort of get together and decide collectively to try to do something about it. You can't wait for sort of history with a capital H to push you, to raise the tides around you in the way that is going to solve all your problems for you.
Yeah.
Okay, Vincent, we've taken enough of your time, I think. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really good to chat. And this should be out if people are listening. This should be Thursday the 30th of November. So if you're in Dublin tonight, get down to Conley Books. But it's possible that happened last night. So
that's fine. That's fine.
Still go to Conley Books.
It was good to see everyone last night at Conley Books.
Thank you so much for that, Vincent.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a million.